This is Radio Parallax, a slightly different perspective from a slightly different view, with topics that include matters in science, technology, history, politics, current events, and whatever we damn well please. And now the host of Radio Parallax, Douglas Everett.
Welcome to the program. We would like to thank all of you who participated in KDVS's annual fund drive last week. We raised quite a bit of money. I believe we were somewhat short of our target. But my feeling is that fundraising at this station should go on more than just 1 week during the year. To that end, we're going to be creating T-shirts. They're not available yet. They won't be available for a few weeks. But when they are, we're going to donate them and make them available to you, Radio Parallax T-shirts. And the money that if you will donate, as people did during the pledge drive, will make this little perk available to you. They'll be very tastefully done and something you'll be proud to wear. I'm certain of that. We enjoyed it very much on last week's program, re-airing a segment that first aired on this program on March 6th with Professor Michael Parenti. Michael Parenti is a very interesting lecturer, and we brought him back for this program. In the second segment today, we will be talking to Dr. Parenti about a book he's written recently about politics in ancient Rome, and specifically Julius Caesar. So I hope you'll stick around the second segment for that. I think you'll find that worth your while. On this program, we like to delve into current events. And of course, what has been dominating current events of late has been war in the Middle East. But we're going to get away from that a little bit today, I think, and deal with a lot of things that have been accumulating. We're going to also read some various columnists and some email that we've accumulated and sort of get up to date, catch up, as it were, on in that department. All right, item, CNN.com. Rodney Dangerfield released from hospital, Los Angeles, California. Comedian Rodney Dangerfield was released from the hospital on April 21st, nearly 2 weeks after undergoing brain surgery to increase his blood flow for another upcoming operation. The 81-year-old comic planned to continue his recovery at home in preparation for heart valve replacement surgery in nearly 2 months, according to his spokesman. Dangerfield, whose films include Back to School, Ladybugs, and Caddyshack, had been hospitalized at the University of California, Los Angeles Medical Center since undergoing a 12-hour arterial brain surgery on April 8th. Well, we're very glad that Rodney Dangerfield is out of danger and is home recovering and will hopefully undergo successful cardiovascular surgery in a couple months. We're big fans of Dangerfield on this program, and I hope that you are too. Rodney's been good for an awful lot of laughs over the years, even if he did pretty much steal all the jokes from Henny Youngman, for which he won the Grammy for No Respect back in 1980. It was a very funny comedy album that Rodney did, but a few years after that, when I was an intern at the medical center in Sacramento, I was walking down the hall, and they had The Best of Ed Sullivan up on one of the television monitors. And as I looked up and listened, I observed Henny Youngman doing pretty much the identical jokes that Rodney recycled something like 18 years later, with which he won a Grammy. But, you know, if you're going to steal, steal from the best. Dangerfield actually first got his break when he wheedled his way onto the Ed Sullivan Show in the early 1960s. He apparently came out and actually made the great legendary stone-faced host crack up at the jokes that he was doing. I remember Rodney from those days back in the 1960s, but you didn't hear much about him until sometime in like the early 80s. He all of a sudden appeared one night on Saturday Night Live, and that was the beginning of seeing him, you know, all over the place. And the joke that he used to open his set on Saturday Night Live, I think, is still his very best, which was, "Ooh, you know, my wife, she cut me down to 2 days of sex a month. Hey, but I was lucky. Couple guys I know should cut out completely." My wife, she said she wanted to have a night of wild sex. So she tied me up to the bedpost. And then she went out. I'll tell you, she's no prize. She came the other day and said she thinks the car's got water on the carburetor. I said, "So where'd you leave it?" She said, "In the lake." So my doctor tells me I gotta get more exercise. Says I need to run 5 miles a day. So I call him 2 weeks later. Doc, I'm 70 miles from home. Now what do I do? And of course, on our program earlier, we had Sean Mitten, big fan of the movie Caddyshack, which does have quite a few Dangerfieldisms in that of note. I think the one that I liked the most was as he's sitting down to the meal, he's going, "Oh, that's a good steak I got there. It's got marks on it where the jockey was hitting it." Through the miracle of modern electronics, my always capable sound engineer, this program's sound engineer, Mr. Edward McMillan, was able to put on some fake laughs, a laugh track, as it were. Interestingly, the creator of TV's laugh track passed away last week. The man who invented canned laughter and in the process changed TV forever died at the age of 93. Mr. Charlie Douglas was, I guess, in the 1950s, a technical director for live TV shows in the early days of the industry when he came up with the idea of developing what he called a laugh machine to enhance or substitute for live audience reactions. He called the first invention the Laugh Box, and it became the basis of a lucrative family business. Now we're going to have, I think, our inimitable Hollywood correspondent, Mr. Rosenblum, is going to talk a little bit about this invention of the laugh machine on one of our upcoming programs. Personally, I think it is mind-numbingly horrible to watch some program like Three's Company or just any of these dreadful sitcoms where these days they seem to feel obliged to add laughter to the setups. I mean, not even the setups, the neutral dialogue, like, "I'm going to get a sandwich." I don't get it. I mean, you know, a show like, even like Get Smart, which was actually a pretty funny program, which you can catch on Nick at Night. I mean, Get Smart, it was Buck Henry and Mel Brooks. I mean, those are two pretty good guys to be writing for television. They added a laugh track. I mean, it's weird to look at it, and, you know, laughs are coming out of nowhere, you know, often inappropriately, and I don't know. I hope that Mr. Douglas is up on a cloud somewhere playing the harp, but for what he's contributed to mankind, I'm not so sure where he wound up. Email sent us from Jill. Something worth reading here. "With all the sadness and trauma going on in the world at the moment, it's worth reflecting on the death of another very important person, which almost went unnoticed last week. Larry LaPrise, the man who wrote The Hokey Pokey, died peacefully in his sleep also at the age of 93. Apparently the most traumatic part for his family turned out to be getting him into the coffin. You see, they put his left leg in, and then all the trouble began." No, I'm kind of getting addicted to this reliance upon the canned laughter. Well, maybe, can you do that with every one of these? All right, I think I'm going to try this next one with canned laughter. We'll see if it can enhance it, if we can enhance Radio Parallax. This one comes out of Harper's Magazine, not necessarily one of America's foremost humor publications, but they had quite a little zinger here on page 17 of the March issue. Knockoffs. "We've created a Munster," was the title. Listed were the titles of books published in China last year. The books were inspired by the success of Who Moved My Cheese by Spencer Johnson. Mr. Johnson's book apparently sold 1.6 million copies in China, despite the fact that most Chinese have never tasted cheese. Well, I guess someone noted that, you know, Who Moved My Cheese? There was something about cheese in the cover that made this a successful bestseller. So imitation being the most sincere form of flattery, and people, you know, trying to cash in on what is a difficult to understand but somehow successful formula, figured they'd better put cheese in their title. So the following were actual book titles in China last year in response to Who Moved My Cheese. Okay, Hey Jun wrote a book called Whose Cheese Should I Move? A man named Chen Tong wrote, Can I Move Your Cheese? Ken Yanning apparently wrote, Who Dares to Move My Cheese? Uh, Here's two I especially like. A Piece of Cheese, : Reading World Famous Fairy Tales with Mom by Yi Sung. Somehow cheese works, stick cheese in the title. And Management Advice 52 from The Cheese by Fang Yuan. And last but not least, Chinese people eat cheese. Who took my meat bun? By Chuang Zhang. All right. I'm not sure I like that, the laugh track. Let's get rid of that. All right. Without a laugh track, let me excerpt here from, I snagged this from the Fresno Bee. I took a ride on the train. And by the way, let me take a moment to put a plug in for Amtrak. On Wednesday, I found myself in the southern San Joaquin Valley, having gone down to Fresno to record an interview which will air on next week's program. And I should do a bit of forward promoting, I think, at this point. President Bush, on Mother's Day, is probably, if all goes according to scheduled plan here, sign a bill that will be passed by the House this week that will outlaw what is the so-called partial birth abortion. A couple of good friends of mine some years back had a child which they discovered late in the pregnancy, very late, something like 35 weeks gestation, that there was a terrible problem with the infant, that there was basically no prognosis for the child to survive infancy, and they had to receive one of what is only 400 to 600 per year, a third trimester termination of the pregnancy. Now, the right wing of this country has gotten on a soapbox. They've gotten on their high horse. They've set out to outlaw what is a procedure done only to 400 to 600 people every year. And it looks as though on Mother's Day, Bush will sign that bill, and that will be the end of that. Well, we're going to have quite a bit to say about this subject on next week's program. I assure you it's going to be compelling listening. Please come back for that a week from today. But in pursuit of this interview, I did go down to the Fresno area and decided to come back. My sound engineer came back in the car. I came back on the train. And I got to tell you, that is a beautiful trip. If you have not taken the train from Sacramento or Davis down to the Bay Area, I would strongly urge you to do so. You see an entirely different perspective of the area of between Benicia and Carquinez that you can see from an automobile. It's quite pretty. It's quite relaxing. It's a great way to travel. Amtrak has got some nice new trains out there on the tracks for you. And, if you haven't done this, you're missing something. Really, take some time and plan a trip where you can really do some sightseeing. You're way up high in the train. You're seeing countryside that's, it's not surrounded by sound walls and strip malls like I-99 and I-5, ever increasingly are. And so you get to see a little bit of the old California. So that's my plug for Amtrak. While on the train, I got a hold of the Fresno Bee and saw Molly Ivins' column. Molly Ivins is a syndicated columnist with Creators Syndicate. She's a Texan. George W. Bush seems to be a favorite target of Molly Ivins. She wrote a book called Shrub, I believe it was, some years back, which talked a bit about that time, the future president. Let me quote a bit from Miss Ivins. Austin, Texas. The sour joke is, of course we know the Iraqis have weapons of mass destruction. We have the receipts. At this point, the administration would probably be delighted if it could find the weapons of mass destruction the Reagan administration gave Saddam Hussein. At least it could point to some weapons of mass destruction. Let me skip ahead. In the weeks before Gulf War II, the United States told the world Saddam Hussein was hiding a mobile chemical laboratory, drones fitted with poison sprays, 15 to 20 Scud missile launchers, 5,000 gallons of anthrax, several tons of VX nerve gas agent, and between 100 tons and 500 tons of other toxins, including botulinum, mustard gas, ricin, and sarin. Also, we said he had more than 30,000 illegal munitions. The United States, which insisted it could not give the United Nations weapons inspector so much as 10 days more to search, so dangerous were these weapons of mass destruction, now says it needs months to find them. In the meantime, we are clearly being set up to put the whole issue of weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, down the memory hole. Here are the lines of argument advanced by the administration so far. One, Saddam did have WMDs, but in a wily plot, he poured them all down the drain right before we invaded, just so he could embarrass Bush. Two, the WMDs are still there, but in some remote desert hiding place we may never be able to find. Just because we haven't found anything doesn't mean it wasn't there, one Pentagon source told the Los Angeles Times. Right. Three, Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, but he handed them off to the Syrians just before we came in, or maybe it was the Iranians. Four, well, maybe Saddam didn't have huge stores of WMDs, but he had critical blueprints, weapons parts, and most ominously, precursor chemicals. So he could have manufactured WMDs. And five, well, maybe he didn't have WMDs ready to deliver. The Pentagon has already backtracked on the Scud missile claim. So far, the U.S. mobile exploitation teams and other special forces have visited 90 of the top 150 hot sites identified by U.S. intelligence. No wonder Hans Blix, head of the U.N. inspection team, said what he got from American intelligence was garbage. I tell you, Molly Ivins, she's a bit of a firecracker, and she doesn't seem overly fond of our president. Now, I want to tell you a bit about some science here. I want to tell you about a trip made up to Fairbanks, Alaska to see the Northern Lights, but we're going to save that for the third segment of today's program. We made some friends up there in Fairbanks, and I got some interesting tales to tell about my search for the Aurora Borealis, which I had never seen. But stay tuned for that. Let's go out here for the first segment here by going back to the go-to guy of American humorist, Dave Barry. Now, if you've been listening to our program in the past, and I hope you have, you'll note that we actually have, from his own mouth, permission from Mr. Dave Barry to read his columns on Radio Parallax. I went to go see Dave Barry in his appearance in Santa Rosa and told him we'd like to read his columns, and he said, go ahead, I don't care. Well, we will. All right, Dave Barry's column here, Sacramento Bee, April 20th, 2003. This was Dave at his best. Let's face it, he says, I don't fathom the world according to rings. Before I get to today's topic, I want to apologize to those readers, both human and elf, who were unhappy with my column on The Lord of the Rings. It turns out that my readership includes some very serious fans of the movie and the classic book by the late J.R.R. Scooter Tolkien. Many of these fans took time out from their busy schedules to write lengthy letters detailing the errors in my column and observe that I am a stupid idiot. Here are some of the specific points they made. I am not making these points up. Quote, for your information, Dick Cheney is not in The Lord of the Rings. Quote, it is not right to refer to Aragorn as Lord Aragorn until he claims the throne of Gondor. He's just a ranger right now who happens to be really good in battle. Quote, I can speak as a rampant fan because I have read the book 40 plus times. Quote, I don't think that you fully understand that if they don't destroy the ring, the world will fall into definite evil. To which Dave Barry responds, these are all strong points. I'm sorry if my column offended you or in any way has caused the world to fall into definite evil. While I'm at it, I also want to apologize to the accordion community for a recent column about Babe Ruth's piano in which I encouraged people to throw accordions into ponds. That statement earned me a stern rebuke from James O'Brien, Ph.D., professor of music at the University of Arizona. Dr. O'Brien informed me that making fun of the accordion is, quote, inappropriate, end quote, and concluded his letter with this menacing statement, quote, Gary Larson did this some years ago, and quality accordionists still boycott his Far Side calendars as a result, end quote. Now, as a humorist, I am all too aware of the devastating effect of being targeted for a boycott by quality accordionists. I don't want to wind up like poor Gary Larson, who today is penniless, dressed in rags, holding a cardboard sign that says he will draw cows for food. So I hereby apologize to Dr. O'Brien, who, according to the internet, has two CDs for sale, quote, Accordion Accord, unquote, and Reason for Squeezin', unquote. All right. I love Dave Barry, and hopefully you do too. So I got to read some more of his column here later on in the column. Dateline, Minnesota. According to a story written by Candace Reynolds of the Duluth, Minnesota News Tribune and brought to my attention by alert reader Brian Ronert, a Duluth man has succeeded in doing something that for most humanity remains only a dream, making wine from tent caterpillars. The man, Ray Rigstad, got the idea from the fact that Minnesota is regularly infested with tent caterpillars, which are also called army worms because during certain times of year, they wear tiny knapsacks. According to the story, Rigstad and his girlfriend collected a large quantity of these worms last June. Rigstad then poured boiling water on them to kill them instantly. Apparently, no worms suffered needlessly in the making of this wine. Then mashed them and added sugar and yeast. Then let it ferment until it was a green liquid, which he then flushed down the toilet. No, wait, that's what I would have done. Rigstad put it in a wine bottle and gave it to people. And Barry goes on in a third item to talk about how someone was manipulating the genes of roundworms to make them apparently less obese, to which he concludes the article by saying, well, if scientists can deactivate the genes that cause a roundworm to gain weight, it stands to reason that in time, they'll be able to deactivate the gene that causes humans to play the accordion. No, just kidding. Please, don't boycott me, quality accordionists. I am truly sorry. Here, have some wine. All right, you're listening to Radio Parallax on KDVS 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. Let's take a break and return for a most interesting chat with Dr. Michael Perini.